Good afternoon. I'm Andy Quiet. I see you're requesting registration numbers. Mine is 1286. This is the first time I've been in this building, and it is just remarkable. The old building was also remarkable for the security risks it posed. I am hopeful that the architects and their discernment of design were good enough to give some consideration to what I'm told by others is the isolation that you judges face in doing your work. And I'm hopeful that they, in their design, took some of that into account to ease that for you. With that having been said, I'd like to turn briefly to this case. I'll have just a few remarks, and then I will share with you a poem, the conclusion of which has a poignant place with regard to what is before us in this case. In this case, we obviously have contended that the statute is perfectly clear. So has the other side. I do believe the statute is clear, but if genuinely and not in just a self-servingly manner, you find it ambiguous, we then reach the issue of statutory interpretation. And the question in that context of what this case is really about. Now, I've given that a lot of thought. And what I have come to is that in that context, if you reach that point, this case is about compassion. Once you open that door, it raises a couple of questions. What causes the least harm? What outcome is the most beneficial? I would suggest that once we reach that place in analysis, your values drive that analysis. As I pondered on this, I was reminded of a parable mistakenly attributed to Jesus about comparing the provision of a fish with teaching someone to fish. Turns out it's an ancient Chinese proverb. But in this case, it is more aptly stated as, is it better on the one hand to give someone a fish or to enable them to learn how to fish? With that having been said, I would like to share a brief poem. Baseball by John Updike. It looks easy from a distance, easy and lazy even, until you stand up to the plate and see the fastball sailing inside, an inch from your chin, or circle in the outfield, straining to get a bead on a small black dot, a city block or more high, a dark star that could fall on your head like a leaden meteor. The grass, the dirt, the deadly hops between your feet, an overeager glove. Football can be learned, and basketball finessed. But there is no hiding from baseball the fact that some are chosen and some are not. Those whose mitts feel too left-handed, who are scared at third base of the pulled line drive, and are first basers scared of the shortstop's wild throw that stretches you out like a gutted deer. There is nowhere to hide when the ball's spotlight swivels your way, and the chatter around you falls still, and the mothers on the sidelines, your own among them, hold their breaths, and you whip on a terrible pitch, or in the infield achieve something with the ball so ridiculous you blush for years. It's easy to do. Baseball was invented in America, where, beneath the good cheer and sly jazz, the chance of failure is everybody's right, beginning with baseball. Anything else I would have to say would be repetitious of what is in the briefs. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Buckman. I'm here on behalf of Celestial Land Company. My bar number is 41006. This case is really about, as was stated by the plaintiff's counsel, the interpretation of the garnishment statute. But it goes further than just the interpretation of the garnishment statute. It's specifically the interpretation as it applies to independent contractors. We also believe that the statute is clear. No statutory interpretation is necessary to arrive at what this statute means with respect to independent contractors. And that's because the definition, which I'm sure everybody has read, includes independent contractors. It's written broadly enough to include independent contractors, as it says, compensation paid or payable for personal services. Independent contractors supply personal services. It also does not limit, it's not limited to traditional employees in the W-2 sense, and nor does it exclude certain classes of workers, in this case, independent contractors. It doesn't exclude contract workers. It doesn't exclude people who may work on a contract basis. There's no exclusionary language in here. It's an inclusive statute. Now, one of the issues that was raised in the briefs is the subsection B, where independent contractors are mentioned. And in there, the term independent contractors they do enjoy certain, the actual statutory benefits, the 25%, 75% benefits of the statute for certain situations, and the list is extremely interesting. It includes arrearages for child support, restitution for theft, embezzlement, wrongful conversion of public property, willful and intentional violation of fiduciary duties to a public pension where the offender received direct financial gain. So in the briefs, plaintiff's argument is that an independent contractor who has committed one of these crimes would enjoy the benefits of the garnishment statute, meaning that independent contractor gets to keep 75% of their income, and the total amount that's garnishable is 25%. But the poor independent contractor who merely defaults on a business debt, all of their compensation, for lack of a better word, is garnishable 100%. So basically what's being said, or what's being argued, is that the statute gives special treatment to this list of independent contractors if they've committed a crime that is included in this list. Whereas the business debt, sorry, you're out of luck.
But I mean, your argument assumes that independent contractors are within the broad definition of earnings, correct?
It does, Your Honor, and I believe that it is.
Well, but why have the subparagraph that specifically identifies independent contractors at all if they're already included in the broader paragraph? I mean, we have to give every provision in the statute some struggle to give it some force and effect. So it isn't the way to give it force and effect that independent contractors aren't within the broad definition of compensation, but they are specifically brought in subparagraph B.
I appreciate your question, and I think that it the words at the end of subparagraph B, it says earnings also mean, and I think that can be read as inclusive of the broader definition of earnings. It also means for this situation for independent contractors, dividends, severance pay, these are all what I would deem gratuitous types of payments to somebody. These don't fall under an earnings type of situation. And here you're looking at severance pay, royalties, monetary gifts. This is gratuitous that the law would then be seeking to recover in a garnishment situation from the independent contractor as well. Sorry for repeating myself, that earnings also means is being inclusive of the broader definition. It doesn't set up a secondary or exclusive type of reading. I think there are other words that might have been used there if that was the intent of the legislature rather than saying also means.
But if subsection A is as broad as you're describing it, doesn't that then make subsection B redundant under your analysis?
I don't believe it's redundant because it sets up a different, these are different payments that are different from compensation. It's inclusive of compensation. So it would set up a separate, well not separate, but it takes into account different situations and different types of payments for those who are arrearages for child support, you know, that encompass the list of criminal or activities that are not condoned by society, not in a work type situation.
And counsel, how would you apply the statutory interpretation principle of Houston Generous here?
I know that was argued by plaintiff's counsel in their brief, and independent contractors were not in the original statute. I mean, there was no carve out for that term of independent contractor. It's an interesting question. The statute, I guess my answer would be the statute doesn't set out a different work type situation or classification of workers or of how people are paid. So by that statutory interpretation principle I don't believe it's excluded elsewhere, I guess is my answer. It's again, coming in today, my interpretation of the statute and what I've asked the court to interpret it as being inclusive. I don't believe I answered your question very well, Your Honor, and I don't know that I've got a perfect answer for that question. And I apologize for that.
That's okay, thank you.
Well, I mean, just going back to the broad language, it uses the terms wages, salary, commission, or bonus. Aren't all of those terms descriptive of an employer-employee or master-servant relationship?
I suppose, Your Honor, they could be interpreted that way. Wages is typically something that is attributed to a W-2 employee.
As opposed to
an independent contractor. And salary could be interpreted the same way. Coming over to commission or bonus, a commission is not something that's regular, necessarily. Somebody in a situation makes one sale in one year and there's a singular commission, there's no regularity to that, which I believe sets it apart from a wage or a salary. Bonus as well. Bonus is not, maybe there are guaranteed bonuses out there, but typically bonuses are something that come once a year, if at all. And therefore, I believe is set apart from wages or salary as well. So while they may be traditional in a sense of an employment situation, there is no regularity to those second two commissioner bonuses as there would be, as we all believe, wages and salary. You're paid a wage and 2 weeks every month, however that may occur, whatever the agreement is between the employer and the employee. So I do believe that these two are different and can be viewed differently because they're, it's not guaranteed and there's no regularity to it.
Well, how does regularity help us distinguish an employer-employee relationship from a relationship involving an independent contractor? I guess if that's a litmus test, I'm having trouble understanding its application.
I don't think it does, but I do believe that plaintiff has argued regularity and has argued that against the debtor in this case. That the debtor's lack of regular payment is something that takes his situation out of the statute and makes it and turns it into a turns it into property because he's not regularly paid. But I believe that in the statute, there are two situations that they deem earnings where it's the same situation. A commission could be an artist. An artist is an independent contractor. Artists are commissioned to produce art, to do something. They're paid one time. Typically, those are considered commissions. This, I would have to guess, it seems to be more in the terms of a sales type commission. Somebody selling cars or selling, you know, what have you. I don't know what other, you know, commission situations there are. So. In this case, the trial court, deemed that independent contractors, as you all know, are within the definition of earnings, and I respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's determination that they're protected in a garnishment situation from poverty and being rendered destitute by determining that 100% of their earnings or whatever they are paid is subject to garnishment. A second issue that was raised on appeal is the discovery issue. And I won't spend a lot of time on the discovery issue, but the an important aspect of the discovery issue is that the discovery that was issued by plaintiff between the time the traverse was filed and the hearing on the traverse was cumulative, it was overly broad, and it was not focused on the issue presented in the traverse. Not to mention, much of this information was obtained by plaintiff in a deposition before the garnishment was even filed or served. And then in a subsequent deposition, one was in January, one was in May. Some of this information was that the debtor admitted being an independent contractor, that he had not voiced Celestial for payment for a number of months, that he invoices when he deemed it appropriate. And he testified in open court. I believe both depositions were held in open court in front of the judge in Pitkin County. The debtor testified about the scope of services to Celestia. So these issues had already been discovered, so to speak, by plaintiff. And in fact, my understanding from the record is that the debtor had been held in contempt of court at least once or twice for failing to bring documents. However, I think it's important that once Celestial was involved in the case through the traverse, there was no attempt to hold the debtor in contempt. There was no attempt to obtain the documents from the debtor through legal means through the trial court. The focus was just shifted to Celestial, because Celestial had an attorney. And they tried, and plaintiff tried to obtain the documents that way rather than pursuing the debtor in the underlying case further. And I know there's plenty of information in the record about the pursuit of the debtor, but further contempt proceedings were never pursued once Celestial was involved. So there's, you know, the discovery was cumulative, not likely to lead to any discoverable information. And that is because Mr. Hoffman, the debtor, had testified for this information on two occasions, once in January and once in May. And we respectfully ask that the court uphold trial court's decision to quash the subpoena and not allow the discovery. The last issue is attorney fees. And Celestial, in our first answer to the garnishment, we submitted an Exhibit A, which is not required under the garnishment form stating how Mr. Kaufman is paid, Mr. Kaufman being the debtor, how he's paid, trying to be forthcoming and transparent with that information, in trying to work with plaintiff's attorney to understand that situation, including stipulating certain facts in open court during the traverse hearing. And I just would respectfully request that the attorney's fee request be denied, 2.0. So thank you all for your time.
I can't tell you how much time I have remaining. Thank you. I'll comment briefly on discovery and then more pertinent issues.
Let me try to, were we to rule in your favor on the garnishment question, would you still need the discovery, or is there, or no, discovery only in aid of your argument about independent contractor and
that time that payment? That's correct. If you accept our first and primary position, that it does move the discovery issue.
Does it also move the rate of assistance issue?
No, sir, it does not.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I think with that guidance, I'm wanting to spend any more time on the discovery issue. Unless there are specific questions. What I would like to turn to is to request and implore you to give the practicing bar some guidance in this matter. This is a recurring kind of issue, but it does not always make it before someone such as yourselves for a variety of obvious reasons. It affects both debtors and creditors. It affects those collection lawyers who specialize in what we call retail collections and those who specialize in what we call commercial collections. Your ruling, whatever it may be, if you choose to give guidance to the bar, will affect both ends of that of a creditor's practice and implicitly affect debtors.
You're talking the rate of assistance?
No, sir. I'm talking on the wage.
The wage, okay.
Earnings issue in particular. Sorry if I wasn't clear.
Okay.
For example, if you were to accept in your discernment the arguments of Mr. Buckman and his client, you then open the door to the possibility that the retail collectors will now start to garnish taxicab companies for the earnings of taxicab drivers and people who work in hair salons or nail salons for their earnings. It's going to have an impact if you happen to go that way. Similarly, if you happen to discern that the best path is the position for which my client and I have argued, that too will have an impact on people. I would suggest that the bar is in need of some guidance on this, and it would be most appreciated. Turning to the definitions in the statute, it is this question or this claim that what a independent contractor provides is personal services belies the language of the statute that occurs on pages 24 to 26 of the opening brief repeatedly, where it refers to independent contractors, not only that phrase, but uniquely it says independent contractors, labor or services. It is using different language with regard to independent contractors than we find elsewhere.
Are you distinguishing between personal services and merely services?
I believe, Your Honor, perhaps further. I'm saying that an independent contractor's labor cannot constitute a personal service based upon the language in the statute.
In other words, you're saying because they use different terms, they must have meant something different, even if the terms are superficially seem to mean the same thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. the policy of the law is to subject all non-exempt assets of a debtor to the payment of lawful debt. This is fundamental to the underpinnings of the rule of law in civil matters and to upholding of contracts. If a court judgment is not enforced, this undermines so much of our commercial dealings. There is, and this comes back perhaps, I'm trying to think where one might parse these issues or how broadly may you perhaps choose to rule or not rule. There is already built into our law a distinct difference between consumer matters and commercial matters. And we do employ a different standard oftentimes with regard to consumer debt than we do with commercial debt. Here we are dealing with commercial debt.
But I mean, absent statutory guidance, we couldn't create a different hierarchy of enforcement mechanisms for one category of debt versus another, could we?
Well, you're asking the wrong lawyer. One of the other lawyers here is also, I know Ms. Topol's here, and she's always fond of saying she's a creditor's guy. I'm a creditor's guy too, and as a creditor's guy, I'd say, no, you cannot. I'm sure there are plenty of debtor's lawyers who would certainly argue differently. But neither of us in either role sit in your position.
Okay.
The court did ask a particularly poignant question on with regard to how regularity helps us distinguish between an independent contractor and an employee. I think regularity alone does not necessarily aid. I think what it is something to keep in mind as you discern what type of ruling you may fashion and how broad you want to be in giving guidance to the bar. The facts of this case do have the regularity issue front and square. Obviously, if you're to give the maximum aid to the practicing bar, I would concur that regularity in and of itself does not help us distinguish between independent contractor and employee in isolation. I think it's when it is taken with other facts, such as the amount of the payment, what else is going on, this issue discussed in the briefs about the need for a living wage to maintain an employee and an employee's capacity to buy food and pay rent. So in isolation, I don't think it adds much that is helpful. With regard to returning to the discovery issue, the issues raised by counsel are not in the record. The matters are, many of the statements are just conclusory. You can moot it by your ruling, but if you choose to go in a manner that sends us back on remand, we would certainly like to have that discovery, and I think it's all in the record and brief before the court. So I thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel.